This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. According to an estimate from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis last week, the U.S. gross domestic product, the GDP, the value of goods and services produced, shrank at an annual rate of 0.3% in the first quarter of 2025. That's the first decline in 3 years.
President Trump largely attributed the decline to former President Biden's economy. Here is Trump speaking at a cabinet meeting last week.
He came in on January 20th. So this is Biden. And you could even say the next quarter is sort of Biden because it doesn't just happen on a daily or an hourly basis. But we're turning it around. It's a big ship to turn around, and we're going to have the greatest country financially in the history of the world ever.
On Friday, the Labor Department reported that U.S. employers added 177,000 jobs in April. Unemployment remained unchanged at 4.2%, both seen as pretty positive numbers.
Those are big picture national numbers. So what does it all mean for Wisconsin?
Steve Deller is a UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist, professor in agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the studio.
Good morning.
Let's look at some of those big, broad national numbers, GDP, gross domestic product, a very, very broad measure. Generally, people view up as good, down as bad. When you look at a little slip, at least the estimate in the first quarter of this year, what does it mean to you? What does it mean for Wisconsin, if anything?
Well, what's happening really is kind of a short-term reaction to the tariff proposals. What really kind of drove the GDP numbers was a spike in imports. That was primarily from businesses trying to build up their inventory, to build up kind of a supply of materials in anticipation of a tariff coming into place. You also saw that with consumer spending. So that spike in imports actually kind of drove GDP down, but the spending kind of counterbalances a little bit. So a lot of businesses right now are kind of going into a wait-and-see mode and kind of hunkering down a little bit.
And we'll dig into that more in just a bit. The job numbers, again, 177,000, more than I think economists had expected. Here in Wisconsin, when we look at unemployment rates, tend to track lower than the national average, right? What are you seeing here in Wisconsin when it comes to jobs numbers?
What we're seeing is the most current numbers that we have for Wisconsin are February. So there's a little bit of a lag between the national data and the Wisconsin data. What we're seeing is a slow, steady, downward tick in the number of new job openings. But we still have a lot more job openings than we have people unemployed. So we still are facing a structural labor shortage. We simply don't have enough people in Wisconsin to fill all the jobs that we have.
And a long-term trend potentially in Wisconsin there. We are an aging state, or last time I checked, we were an aging state. People retiring, not necessarily the young people to fill those jobs. Is that structural problem you see something not just this year, but on out into the future?
I think going on out, a lot of attention was drawn to the labor shortage after the COVID because it was kind of in our face. But you could go back almost 10 years to see a structural labor shortage in Wisconsin. We're an aging as a state, and we're not seeing as many people moving into Wisconsin as we are generating jobs.
Now, getting into tariffs, people watching for the impact, as you mentioned, manufacturers and some consumers rushing to buy stuff before tariffs kicked in. I'm just looking at ABC Supply, big company here in Wisconsin. They've been posting their suppliers. So here's one, roofing, residential roofing projects, a company saying, hey, we're bumping up 5%. Here is one, 10 to 15% on fasteners and plates for construction. Here's another one, 5.5% tariffs on construction supplies. The list goes on and on. Are we going to start, now that that stock-up time has ended, are we going to start seeing the impact on fields like construction in Wisconsin, manufacturing, as they see those prices bump up?
That's exactly right. The challenge that we have from the economy is that we're not sure. The president seems to be imposing the tariffs, backing off the tariffs, imposing the tariffs, backing off, creating kind of pathways for certain industries. So the real problem, you know, the tariffs are kind of gathering a lot of news right now, but I think what's kind of undermining the economy is all the uncertainty. We don't know what the policy is going to be, and it's really difficult to make long-term purchasing decisions or long-term investment decisions if we simply don't know what's going to be going on.
Right. The hope when you impose tariffs as a country is it may be a little pain now, and President Trump has made this argument, but that's an incentive to make more stuff here in the United States so that those roofing supplies, say, that might have come from Canada, for example. Maybe we start producing them here. With that uncertainty, does that make it harder for that potential manufacturer to say, yep, I'm going to step up and do this now?
It takes a long time. If a company decides they're going to move their production facilities back to the U.S., that's a major undertaking. That is not something that can be done in the short term. These are, you know, can be potentially billion-dollar investments. And a lot of companies are not going to be making those kind of investments with this kind of uncertainty. They're going to go into a kind of a hunker down, let's wait and see mode, and let's try to ride this out. That kind of mentality is going to trigger a recession.
Let's go to the consumer side of things. Now, seeing reports, the Pacific ports that bring in a lot of imports in the United States, consumer goods, manufacturing goods, whatever, 60% drop, I think I saw in some of our biggest ports in the country in the amount of stuff coming in. What will Wisconsinites start to see as those cargo hauls get shorter and shorter?
What's going to happen is that a lot of the stores, say on retail, a lot of the stores like the Walmarts and the Targets, kind of the Dollar General, the type of stores that are kind of targeting a modest income households, they're the ones that are going to be hit the most. Because most of those products are coming in from overseas. We tend to focus on China, but a lot of it's coming in from, say, Vietnam. It's coming in from other countries. One of our biggest trading partners is actually Ireland, and it's because of the pharmaceutical industry. So while we tend to focus on China, it's broader than just simply China.
In our last few moments, Steve, let's look at agricultural exports. Another uncertainty is retaliatory tariffs, soy, dairy, whatever we're exporting from Wisconsin. What are you watching for there?
What I'm watching for is some of our largest trading partners. And here, population matters. So China does matter, has an outsize because of the size of the country, is that they're going to start looking for other trading partners. With the first tariffs under the first Trump administration, China started saying, we're going to start buying a lot of our soybeans from Brazil. And once we lose those contracts, it's going to be very, very difficult to get them back.
Steve, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and professor at UW-Madison, looking at big economic trends and what they mean here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, are stores selling nicotine products to underage buyers? Check out the results of a new state survey.
There's still a significant portion selling to underage buyers, and so we still have a lot of work to do to bring that down.
That's ahead on WPR News. Now, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services is seeing a decline in tobacco and vape sales to underage users.
The annual statewide assessment of retailer violation rates dropped from 13.5% in 2023 to 11.8% in 2024.
Still higher than pre-pandemic rates. Health officials are optimistic, though, about the progress, but they say more work needs to be done to make sure retailers don't sell to people under 21 as required by federal law.
Dr. Mark Wagner is a chronic disease medical advisor for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services and an adjunct associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Wagner, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's start with this survey information out from the Department of Health Services. Why is it important to go out and check compliance and whether places that sell tobacco and nicotine products are selling to people under 21?
Yeah, sure. Well, the main thing, we had a change in the federal law in 2019. So it no longer, it used to be 18-year-old and under was the underage. And now it's 21 and under, and that's the federal law. The state law did not change to match that. But despite that, the federal law is still what is in effect. So there is confusion on the state level because of that not having the change in the state law. So we have had this program in place to monitor compliance with sales to underage buyers for since early 2000s. And we've seen that it's had a great impact. It was able to bring the numbers down right before the law changed from 18 to 21. We saw only about 5.5% of Wisconsin retailers were selling to individuals underage. Then when the law on the federal level changed to 21, we saw the numbers go up a little bit, and it was about 13.5% in 2023, and now it's coming down again, about a little under 12% from our last survey. And so we're grateful to all the retailers who have been following the law and making sure not to sell, make underage tobacco sales. But there's still a significant portion selling to underage buyers. And so we still have a lot of work to do to bring that down.
I want to go through the progression of the numbers here because there's a lot of yes, but things going on. So the number went down from 2023 to 2024. Good news. But wait, that's twice as high as pre-pandemic. Bad news. But wait, that may have been nudged by that change in the federal age. So I don't know what kind of news. How do you weigh the long-term trends on compliance here?
Yeah, well, I think the long-term trend is we've seen that since this program was implemented, it works to help reduce the sales to underage buyers. I think it's as long as we have that discrepancy between the state law and the federal law, we will have confusion and some enforcement issues at the state level. So that will keep driving underage sales. So we are continuing to educate retailers to make sure they understand that 21 is the age. And we have free training available for retailers at witobaccocheck.org that gives people study guides, online training on at no cost to the retailers. And then they can receive a certificate showing that they've completed that training. And they can order free resources as well to prevent underage sales if they visit our website at dhs.wisconsin.gov/tobacco/tobacco21.
One recommendation from the Department of Health Services is, you know, most tobacco and vape and such like products, they're behind the counter. There are a few exceptions. Sometimes you see the flavored cigarettes out where people can pick them up, bring them up to the counter. Is having consistency there, it might seem like a small thing, but is that something that might help prevent maybe even that underage person from trying to get that particular product?
Yes, consistency is very key. And that's another thing about the 21 law is it applies to all tobacco products. But having consistency in placement is very important. And you mentioned flavors, and that is really the hugest driver of youth use of tobacco products. It's because the flavors draw the youth in. The flavored tobacco products are often the very first tobacco product a young person is going to try. And we've seen in surveys that of kids who have used commercial tobacco products, about 4 in 5, 80% started with a flavored tobacco product, and about 2 out of 3 users say they continue to use those tobacco products because they come in flavors I like. And when you look at middle schoolers, it's almost universal, about 96% say they probably wouldn't even try an e-cigarette, which is the most popular tobacco product among youth today, if it didn't have those flavors.
I want to talk about that 21 age change just from not that long back. What was the reason, what's the thinking behind going from 18 to 21 as we did at the federal level?
Sure. Well, the younger an individual is, if they're starting to use tobacco products, they're more susceptible to the harms. Nicotine can harm parts of an adolescent's brain that control attention, learning, mood, impulse control, and that exposure to nicotine during childhood can have adverse effects on learning, brain development. So the longer that we can keep individuals off of tobacco products, the better. And you know, once someone starts, it is very difficult to stop. And so we give someone the chance for if we can intervene early and keep them from getting the habit, we can set them up for a lifetime of healthy behavior.
We're talking to Dr. Mark Wagner, chronic disease medical advisor for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, looking at youth access to tobacco and nicotine products after the latest survey of retailers to see if kids could successfully buy tobacco products. Dr. Wagner, again, going back to the big picture, it seemed like we had a trend of cigarette use, tobacco use going down, down, down for years with kids. Vaping comes along and nicotine use starts to go up. Can you tell us what you've seen over the years, over the decades with those trends?
Yeah, well, and it comes down to, I think the industry understands that, you know, just as we do, we want to prevent people from starting early, but they understand that if they can get to someone early, they will have probably a good source of income for that person's life while they continue to be addicted. So they have used different methods to sort of attract youth. And the flavors that we talked about are one. Another thing right now that is becoming more popular are these things called smart vapes, which have a higher nicotine content a lot of the time. And they also incorporate technology, like there are games you can play on the vape itself. Some of these look like a music player. You can play music from your phone through the vape. So it gives those addictive things that youth are attracted to, screen time, electronics, the flavors, all puts them all into one. Kind of gives it an extra cool factor for youth so that they are more enticed to try these things. So I think that's a huge challenge, is looking at things like that where you combine all these different things that appeal to youth. So there's a lot for us to fight back against to try to counter these different things.
It sounds like a challenge to parents, among others, Dr. Wagner. In past generations, you watch for, you know, the unmistakable smell of cigarette smoke, for example. What are people suggesting parents watch for now and maybe talk to their kids about in this new era of nicotine?
Sure. We have actually a great campaign about that, which is the Tobacco is Changing campaign, and that people can go to our website, tobaccoischanging.com, and that will provide a lot of great information about all the different tobacco products that are gaining popularity with youth. As well as the type of flavors and packaging that sort of draw people in, gives tips for talking to your kids. It's kind of a one-stop shop for tobacco information. And also teachers are very important because kids spend a lot of their time in schools. So schools and teachers are important. And if teachers visit that tobaccoischanging.com, they can find prevention tools for their classroom, including resources to help teens quit tobacco use. And just, I think another thing that's important on that website is it can show you that e-cigarettes now come in all shapes and forms. They can look like flash drives, but even newer products now resemble everyday items like a smartwatch or hoodies or backpacks. Like even the drawstring of a hoodie could be an e-cigarette device.
Bottom line, Dr. Wagner, let's think of a hypothetical 16-year-old. This month they start a flavored vape product of some sort, and they're hooked. What do we worry about with their health in the years to come?
Sure. Well, for one thing, the addiction, of course, and just we've already talked about the impacts that can have on an adolescent brain. Then even for young people, getting into nicotine and tobacco products can make it harder for them to fight off other infections. We saw back during the COVID pandemic that there was a 5 times higher risk of COVID in youth who vaped versus those who did not. And we've seen studies in mice that show the disruption of lung function that happens, even with exposure to vape fluid that doesn't contain nicotine. So it can have issues early on with difficulty fighting off infections and the addiction. But of course, then the long-term things, if an individual becomes addicted and moves to other commercial tobacco products, traditional products, the harms there are well known, all different types of cancers, heart disease, stroke, other lung infections, it can make other diseases worse, can make it harder to keep your blood sugar under control if you have diabetes. So just a whole host of health effects.
Dr. Wagner, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to get the word out.
Dr. Mark Wagner is a chronic disease medical advisor for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services and adjunct associate professor at UW-Madison. He was with us today to talk about a decline in underage tobacco and vape sales and how the state can further improve that trend.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a new PBS documentary shows how public libraries are at the heart of communities.
Bringing people together, helping them to be literate as best we can, enjoying one another, those values just don't change.
Hear from a Wisconsin librarian featured in the film Free for All. That's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A new PBS documentary explores the origins of the public library and how they can be at the heart of communities today.
This documentary reminded me of my own trips to the children's reading area when I was little and how cozy and calm that part of the library was. It was a little sanctuary compared to other parts of the building. Rob, do you have any early memories of libraries?
I remember as a kid doing a library summer program where we made costumes. I was a Roman centurion for some reason. There was a lot of tinfoil.
Rob and the Roman armies, that's about right, at the library. Well, I think that gets at a point in the documentary. So many different things are possible inside these spaces. To learn more about the new documentary, we're joined by Elizabeth Timmons, librarian at Mule Public Library in Seymour in eastern Wisconsin. Elizabeth is in this documentary. Welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Don Logsdon is here, director and narrator of PBS documentary called Free for All, the Public Library. Don, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Don, as you were making this film, you drove all over Wisconsin visiting libraries, from what I understand. Some of them were from your childhood. I think your mom was along as well. What was that like for you to revisit some of these libraries?
Oh boy, it was very nostalgic, and especially for my mom, I think, because she'd been using those libraries like 70 years ago, originally. The funny thing that we encountered is an awful lot of the Carnegie libraries that we used when we were kids are no longer libraries. They're either historical centers or, in one case, in Hayward, Wisconsin, where we used to go a lot to the Lake Couderay up there, it was now a bicycle repair shop. Another one, it was a yoga studio. I think they just outgrew the original buildings. And in some cases, they built additions onto the old libraries, but in most cases, they built brand new big libraries.
What prompted you to start this project? What was that first impetus?
I started hearing a lot of people telling me that we didn't need libraries anymore. And that we have the internet, so you don't need libraries anymore, which really, you can only think that way if you haven't been in a library in about, 30, 40 years. They have a plethora of things that you can check out. And they're not just a place to store books, they're a place for people to come together.
And Elizabeth, you are in the documentary and you work at the Mule Public Library in Seymour, a town with a few thousand people. Can you talk about the relationships with your patrons and what your library means to the community?
Certainly. Thank you for the question. We know all of our patrons by name. We're so blessed. We know the families. We know the ups and downs of what's going on. And it's just very comfortable and welcoming.
There is one storyline in the documentary, Don, where it's a family with, you know, these homeschooled children, 14, 16 kids in the family, really big family. They totally rely on the local library for most of their schooling materials. And at one point, the mother mentions finding a book that had content she didn't like, you know, that not wanting her kids to be checking out or exposed to. What was that story like to discover, and what can you tell us about it?
It was a chapter in a series of Japanese novels, and the child in question had actually requested it from another branch. It wasn't one that was normally kept on the shelves at that library, but they did have other editions of the book. And I guess the mom saw the book, was upset about some of the content, brought it to the librarian, and it went through a very formal process of review by the community and by the library representatives, where they've had to all fill out a lot of paperwork. And essentially what happened is that the community made a decision in that case to leave the book where it was. And at the time I thought, well, that's kind of anticlimactic for us. But as filmmakers, you're always looking for like the more dramatic story. But
where's
in the
tension?
Was,
yeah,
exactly. In the end, I was like, no, this is telling me something. It's like, this is the place where we have civil discussions and work out difference in a lot of situations. And that was a much more poignant ending to that story. And they still use the library religiously, that family, as far as I know. And I just wanted to give a shout out. That library is the Columbus Library, which is about an hour away from Elizabeth's.
Don, you look back at the history of public libraries, which is so fascinating. And you forget about the struggles, right? And how books were not accessible to the majority of people for so long. Can you talk about the change there?
Of course. In terms of the accessibility of reading material, I mean, my grandpa grew up on a farm outside of Sparta where in his one-room schoolhouse, there was one textbook for many years, and the teacher would hold it, and the kids couldn't touch it, and they couldn't take it home. So when a little library in a box from the Wisconsin Library Commission arrived in his town, it really literally changed his life. And today we take that kind of thing for granted because there's so much access to information.
Elizabeth, what comes up for you as you think about the history of public libraries and how that is informing what happens in these spaces today?
I just can't express how honored I am to be a part of this historical thread. I learned so much myself in that documentary. You have a conflicting and just hard person to understand, Carnegie. He has this dream to build all these libraries, but in the same point, he's building them on the workers' backs and breaking up labor unions. And then, of course, the segregation of libraries. I learned that in school, but when you see it in the visuals, it's just unbelievable to me. So we're past that, thank goodness. And we had leadership that understood we needed to get past that. Our history is complicated. I just can't say enough about being a part of everything. I just have to say real quick, I grew up in Chicago. We had a very crabby librarian. She did not like children. As a librarian now, I never want to be that person.
Elizabeth Timmons with us, a librarian in Seymour, Wisconsin, featured in this film, Free for All, the Public Library. We have the director and narrator of this documentary, Don Logsdon, with us. Elizabeth, have you seen your role as a librarian change as you look at how libraries are changing over the decades and over the centuries?
You know, that's such a great question. I mean, the values are the same. As evolving as it is, I keep up with my library system and the trainings, and then I bring that home.
Don, you have concerns, though, about small-town rural libraries and their ability to stay with us. What makes these libraries more vulnerable than libraries in bigger cities?
Really good question. I think what makes them more precious is that in a lot of these towns, they were some of the last public gathering places. You know, a lot of what we used to take for granted is gone now. Different community centers or the old cafe that was on Main Street where everybody would hang out, even in some towns, post offices are gone. And the library is sort of still standing as that place where everybody in the town is welcome. You know, unlike a coffee shop or a Starbucks, you don't have to spend money to be there and spend time there. Unlike church, you don't have to all agree on the same exact denomination and theology. It's everybody's welcome. So that, I think, is super important in a small place where there aren't that many places that you can go to that are open to the public. But the danger of that is that once they're gone, there's no place left for that kind of civil dialogue. And what a lot of these libraries are facing, huge budget constraints, which was already in full force when we started the film. What's really picked up steam is the other big threat to these libraries, which is a lot of political opposition. People who don't want to pay taxes for their libraries anymore, don't think that if they don't use them, they shouldn't have to pay for them, even if the kids down the block still use them and all of their neighbors, their senior citizens, and then opposition to some of the materials that are in the collection.
Elizabeth, despite the funding issues, despite book challenges, what is it about libraries that will ensure they survive for coming generations?
It has to be the joy and understanding from the community. And so, for example, we're in a capital campaign right now to add a makerspace onto the back of our building. And those people that give me a dollar toward the project, they want it. And there's a lot of those people. Frankly, sometimes I feel like if we're not doing our job, if we're not shouting from the rooftops how fabulous we are.
Well, Don and Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Don Logsdon, director and narrator of a new PBS documentary. It's called Free for All, The Public Library. You can watch it now on PBS. We also spoke with Elizabeth Timmons, a librarian in Seymour, who is featured in the film.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Lauren Cox, and Avery Lee Rogers. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.